Welcome back to another episode of the Huxley Morton podcast, where this week I am joined by Lisa Fazioli. Lisa, it's been a while trying to get you on the show, but I am very excited about this one. And I guess, yeah, just talking to you now off air has got my head spinning with a million and one questions. But I'll kick off as I always do and just ask, first of all, how did you get into clinical research?
Well, thank you for asking. And it's so good to actually get to talk. And I know this was a long time coming. We should have done this a long time ago. And that was on me. And I appreciate that we're getting to do it now. So I came into clinical research. My path is not necessarily the best path. And when I tell people like how to get into the industry, this is how I did it. But as I've been here, I've observed folks that have maybe not had to do it in as hard of a way as I had to do it. So when I came into the industry, I was a master's prepared social worker. So that's what I did before this. That just means that I have my MSW. And when I was in grad school, I actually did a graduate practicum, which is kind of like how we describe our clinicals, like our last year within the program. We typically, in addition to going to school, we also have a job that we have to hold. And so that program I did within the VA system of care, which here in the US, that's our veterans hospitals. Mm-hmm. So I got exposure to working within a VA through that practicum. When I got out of school, I spent a little bit of time as a very traditional social worker. And I went into, after spending a brief period of time in social work, I went into a position that was research, but not clinical research. So I had a different job title, but at the end of the day, my role was very similar to a research coordinator. It just wasn't within clinical research. Mm-hmm. So this particular job was kind of interesting. It was doing policy work, and it was looking at outcomes pretty no-brainer research hypotheses that we're presenting. If you give someone a scholarship for school, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Like, does that help people if you give them a scholarship, or does it hurt people? And I mean, the study is still ongoing. It's like a 20-year outcome study. So we'll have to wait another 5 or 10 years before we get our answers. But I think we can all assume that, free education is better than paying for education. So that's essentially what this particular project was centered on. Closing the gap that we have, particularly in nursing, and I can talk a long time about how this isn't necessarily the right way to do it, but that's beyond the point. But this was essentially just kind of looking, we just like you would randomize within a clinical trial, people were randomized to either get a scholarship or they were randomized to not get a scholarship, and you follow them. So that was my first kind of research coordinator role, albeit it wasn't within clinical research. Mm-hmm. So after I left that position, it was grant funded research. And as folks who work in grant funded research know, the money can just disappear like that and off you go. And it's very hard being able to replace a grant once you've lost it. So from this grant funded research, I went over to a VA. I was not trying to be a research person. So mm-hmm. at this time in my life, my husband and I had made the decision that we were moving out of where we lived, and we wanted to go live in Seattle, Washington. For whatever reason, at that time, we thought we would enjoy living in a place where it rains every day. So we packed up our bags and we moved to Seattle, Washington. And we did this without jobs, which was very scary to do. So we had no jobs and we kind of just showed up there. We had no family or friends at that time in the area. And I wanted just access to better opportunity. You don't have to do this, though. I tell people, you don't have to go live in your car to try to find better opportunity. That's not the message.
Subject yourself to rain every day as well.
You could do that over here
in London.
I know. I say that, and then I'm like, I'm being insensitive to your geography. It's hard. Seattle's it's a hard place to live long term. But when I was there, I really enjoyed it. So we showed up, we didn't have jobs and we tried our very best to make something happen for ourselves. And I really believed that I'd have better opportunities in Seattle than I would from the city that I came from. And this was during, I came into my professional life during the 2008 financial crisis. So that's where I started my career. And because of that, you know, there was a time in my life where absolutely no one in my family had a job. I didn't have a job. My parents didn't have a job. You know, every house on the block was for sale. It was a really kind of bleak time. And I had some barriers. You know, I didn't have a parent that could make a phone call and make something happen for me, right? They didn't have jobs either. Yeah. So it was really hard getting my career going. And even going into something like social work, where there's this kind of misconception that if you have a social work degree, you're very much in demand. That's not true. There's a need for social work positions. There is not funding for those positions. So if you want to be a paid social worker making even $26,000 a year at that time, there were slim pickings, especially in the geography that I came from. So
yeah,
I say that because this essentially kind of qualifies why one thing we were talking about before we got the interview started was posting on LinkedIn, you know, trying to tell people how they can do something. And it comes from that place. My career did not come easy to me. It came extremely hard. And for a very long period of time, I thought it would never happen for me. So research was not my first career. It wasn't my second. It wasn't my third. This was a long time in the making. So with that, that's why I care about, you know, giving people information. Again, just my career did not come easy to me, but I have a really successful career today. And I hope that other folks who are maybe younger in their careers and are struggling can maybe, I don't know, have some hope that things can change. And sometimes you can fall or put yourself into the path of the right position. So for me, out there in Seattle, I was trying to actually find social work jobs. Yeah. And I was applying for any and everything. Like, there was nothing that I wouldn't apply to. I needed a job, right? So there was nothing that I wasn't willing to do. And I saw a very interesting position posted within the VA. And it was for something that I didn't know what it was. It was actually an institutional review board, which is what we call the ethics committees in the US. Yeah. So it was a position with an IRB within the VA system of care. And I thought it was really intriguing to work in research. So I applied for this position. I was really surprised that I got an interview. But this role also allowed you to be a non-scientific member that sat on the actual committee. Mm-hmm. It was something that was not for, it was really wasn't, I wasn't prepared for that role at that time because I didn't really have that clinical research experience.
Do you remember the name of the role? Did it have a name? Because sometimes these things, you never really know what it is until you get there. It's like assistant or support and you like, it
yes,
doesn't have
exactly
a title. Did it have a title or?
So within this particular VA, every role has a position at this particular center of clinical scientist, research health scientist, or science specialist. It's some version of that is how all the roles are described. So it could be, you could be an investigator with a clinical research scientist role. You could be someone, you know, shuffling paperwork with a very similar title. So at this particular institution, it was even more challenging to figure out what the roles actually did. But this was the unofficial title that we use because we can't just call everyone a scientist in our research department, right? So this was, I want to say it was IRB, it was like an IRB specialist, a coordinator or member, something to that effect. Mm-hmm. So when I went into the interview, they seemed to like me. But they also, because it's Seattle and there's a lot of Nordic sensibilities in the region, they're very blunt in their communication. They let me know within the interview, like, we don't think you're prepared for this role and I don't think it would be a good fit for you. And I was crushed because you typically expect to be ghosted by an interviewer if it's not going well. And a lot of times we say we back, right? I want feedback about why I wasn't selected for a role. But if you've ever really gotten feedback and it was blunt like that, where they said, you are just not prepared for X, Y, and Z reason, yeah, that's actually not fun to get either. But I'm glad
it's
that
they... It's quite brutal. Looking back on it now, though, are you glad that you got it, or would you prefer to be ghosted?
Yeah, if nothing would have happened with the job, I would have rather have been ghosted.
Interesting. Yeah. I asked because I was dealing with someone recently, and I said, look, would you mind if I give you some honest feedback? And they were like, no, go ahead. Like, it will really help. Yeah. And I was like, you don't meet this, and this. So for that reason, I couldn't possibly go forward. How would you react if you were in my shoes? And they were like, wow, that was brutal. Perhaps have preferred to just not hear nothing. And I was like, that's why I asked. But you know, it's one of these weird things. Everyone thinks that they can deal with it until they get that crushing news sometimes.
Exactly. And I've actually had, you know, the job that I was referencing before, where I worked with, I was an employee of a hospital, but doing this kind of non-clinical research. That job, they actually called me and they said, you know, you didn't get the job. This was on a voicemail. And we really appreciate your time, but you know, you didn't get it. And so I actually called them up afterwards. And I was really scrappy at this time. I was really desperate for work. Again, this is the financial crisis. I'm willing to do anything for a job. And so I called them and I said, I want to know why. Like, will you please just return my call and tell me why I didn't get this job? Because if there's any way I can overcome it, I need to know that. And so they called me back and they said, you know, we're really looking for someone to hit the ground running, and this person really needs to have an understanding of this particular system. I don't even know what the system was, but it was some system. Like, because this is how we use it to manage the workload. And we've got another candidate that we're going to make an offer to. So I heard, okay, you haven't made an offer though. So they have another candidate they're going to make an offer to. They have experience within the system. They would basically be working, you know, in their first week, they'd be productive, and we think it would take you some time for training. So I said, that's not a good enough reason for me, because whatever this system is, I'm sure I can learn it. It can't, I mean, what does it require? Advanced calculus to know how to do it? Like, if that's the case, then I don't know, maybe it'll take me a long time. But if it's just, you know, some random system, I'm certain that I can learn how to use it. Yeah. And, you know, so what? Someone get started a week or 2 weeks sooner than me. If you want me to start now before I'm on the payroll, I will, and do whatever I can on my own dime to get training. I'll do that. And what they heard was that I was really persistent on this job, right? I don't know that I'd do that again, like, in my career, but hopefully I don't have to. But I really was extremely motivated at that time, right? So I turned that no into a yes by calling and asking for the feedback so that I could overcome it. And in that case, the feedback was, it should not have been limiting to me to have gotten this position. So we overcame it. They gave me the job. But then in this case, right, we always say we want feedback. And I say something similar to folks as well. You know, if you're tired of being ghosted on these opportunities, but I can probably give you honest feedback. Like, I can guess why they're not giving you this job. It doesn't feel as good as you think it's going to feel when you get that. And in this case, it felt horrible. I really wanted to cry. And I think they could tell that I was saddened to hear this. So as I was kind of doing the walk of shame, you know, as they said, you know, it's not going to work out. And they walked me, you know, down the, you know, enormous, you know, maze that is this hospital that I was in. I was like, oh, it's a long way to get out of here. So as they were kind of walking me out the door, one of the women in the interview, who was kind of like my chaperone to get me to and from the outside the building into, you know, into the depths of the building where the interview
make sure was you going. Left.
Yeah, make sure that I left, right? I didn't try to weasel my way into another job there. So she said, you know what, you don't have the experience for this job. And it's very clear, just, you know, in the interview, as part of the feedback that they gave me, is that you just don't have a strong enough of a research background. And I was surprised at that time, because I thought, what is there really to know? I mean, I have a master's degree. I've studied research. I even had all those you know, the human subject certifications that you need to get before you get started. A lot of times in graduate programs, you have to do that on the off chance that you're going to, you know, start engaging in research with human subjects. So I thought, well, I kind of, what is there to know? I know a lot. I've taken, you know, taken a research class. I have a certification. What else do you need from me? So this particular woman said, you know, wasn't the right opportunity, but there's another department. And I think you could potentially be a really good fit for another position within the organization, not working on IRB, but maybe there's something else for you. So I kind of expected that absolutely nothing would happen, but to my very pleasant surprise, they called me back. They set me up with another interview and I got that job. And that's the position. It was actually supposed to be a coordinator role, simply just kind of limited to a research coordinator role. But very quickly after I came into that position, they let me know, well, the woman who was my boss, who gave me wonderful mentorship, said in so many words, I'm tasked to the max. I have so many studies going on right now. And so I could honestly really use another project manager. So is that something that you'd be receptive to doing the project manager role? And so I was like, wow, I haven't been here that long. So yes, the answer is yes, 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 and yes. Mm-hmm. And did I get any money for that role, making that transition? No. I didn't get a dime extra for taking on that responsibility, but I didn't quite know at that time, but my mom told me, she said, do it, just do it, because it'll get you more experience. And I have a hunch, you know, I'm 2 weeks into my research career, and my mom was like, I have a hunch that this is going to be a really good thing for you. So I think you should just, you know, you should definitely do it and get all the experience you can. And that's one of the areas that I see a lot of times people limit themselves in, that they get an opportunity to do something else in their organization and they don't want to do it without the pay increase.
Gotcha.
And sometimes, like, this is advice that doesn't go over well with everyone.
I think it's one of those things, isn't it? And I don't know who came up with the saying, but it's like, if you do more than what you're paid for, eventually you'll get paid for more than what you do. And it's just elevating yourself to that point. I'm probably completely screwing up that phrase, but it's something along those lines, right? And it's just like you're saying, take the opportunity. Don't worry about the immediate remuneration for it. Just know that you're paying your dues and it's going to come back. Now, you didn't necessarily see it, but your mum kindly pushed you in the right direction at that point.
Yes.
Thanks, Mom.
She always knew now, that the research is going to be great.
Yeah, and then now you can perhaps look back on this, and you know, you've walked me down this memory lane trip of how you became a PM so soon. But now I guess that I know you as kind of, and I see you when you talked about LinkedIn a short while back. I've come across your profile. We've never spoken prior to jumping on this podcast together, but I class you as kind of an experienced PM who knows what she's talking about, offers back to the community. And you've built almost kind of like this little personal brand for yourself. So I've got a couple of questions about the LinkedIn side of things down the road. But first and foremost, I guess you didn't really know what you were perhaps doing back then, but as an experienced PM now, or clinical project manager, what is it that clinical project managers do, Lisa? You know, because we talked about it briefly beforehand and I advertised my own ignorance to you off air, but what is a clinical project manager? What do you guys do?
Yeah, so I'm going to, so I gave kind of my background and how I got into research, right? Yeah. And now the rest of the discussion, I'm going to put on my CRO cap, because that's where I've spent a lot of my career. And I know that that's where a majority of folks are looking to get into project management within either more folks are trying to get into the industry side. So when we say industry, we mean typically working for a sponsor or working for a CRO. But it's not an easy job anywhere, but the job can look a little bit different. So within a CRO, the project manager is, I will say, the most important, one of the most important roles to make sure that the study runs smoothly within the CRO. Mm-hmm. And so the project manager is really making sure that every single functional group understands kind of what they're doing and when. And we can be pretty siloed by our expertise within our particular area. So there are a lot of disciplines that come together to make up a clinical trial. Mm-hmm. And this is the piece that can be very challenging, especially when someone comes from maybe a more niche research organization like myself, coming from working within the VA system of care. And we have maybe less groups that you're essentially overseeing. But within a CRO, a full service CRO, there's different types of CRO. So some CROs can be very specialized in the services that they provide. They mm-hmm. may be a CRO that just does outcomes development and protocol design. There could be a CRO that just does data management and biostatistics. But mm-hmm. for the most part, when I speak towards CRO, it's speaking towards a full service CRO. So we could do every single part of the clinical trial. When you're ready to go into, you're ready to take your drug into a person, then that's where we essentially get started. So to run a clinical trial in humans, you have to have so many disciplines that come together, and the project manager essentially needs to make sure that every single discipline, that for more or less, they're experts in their own area, and they mm-hmm. can be a little bit siloed. And a project manager needs to make sure they essentially understand their tasks, how their tasks relate to other person's tasks. Mm-hmm. What essentially, we use the term in CROs in particular, and on the sponsor side as well, but we use the term rate limiting, which just is a fancy way that we describe what is something that kind of has to happen before something else can even get started or can mm-hmm. happen. So as a project manager, that's one piece, is the oversight of the clinical trial and helping your team know when tasks need to be completed and how they're connected to one another.
So if it were to put into a sports scenario, for example, say football, it's kind of like the quarterback, is it? Kind of, you are sat in the middle, there's individual have their own speciality, but you are kind of, you've got the game plays, you know what you're doing, and you have to make sure that the ball needs to go there in order for this person to catch it, to go there, and et cetera, et cetera. Is that a fair assessment? Yes. Or?
I think so. I will say I know significantly less about football than I do about clinical trials. I don't even think I know how to play football. So, but that sounds right. I can say an example that I understand or I use sometimes.
Yeah.
Is, we're essentially, the project manager is almost like a conductor of a symphony. So
yeah.
I don't know, as the project manager, there are some tasks that I fundamentally, you could not give them to me and say, hey, Lisa, could you go ahead and, you know, get us our Atom data set? Like, I couldn't do that for you. I wouldn't know how to get started. Right. But so in our, you know, analogy of say using a symphony, like I might not know how a particular instrument is played. I couldn't get mm-hmm. in there and play it myself, but I know exactly when we need to hear it. And
gotcha. You're conducting the band. Yeah.
Same
kind of analogy. And again, that's why I like these things, so that people who perhaps aren't in industry yet can relate and be like, oh, okay, yeah, I get this.
Yeah, exactly. So you have to know the challenging part of that is that, you know, a lot of times, you know, people say, oh, I want to be the project manager because they just tell people what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And delegation is a huge part of the project manager role, of course. But
yeah.
even just knowing, like, even if my role as a conductor would be, okay, you just tell people what to do and when to come in.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I mean, like the football example too, like, well, I don't know how to play football, so I wouldn't be a good quarterback because I'd have to do some learning and I'd have to get some experience under my belt. So I could say, hey, you know, football person, you throw the ball at this time. I mean, I can't even get it going. But essentially, you have to have a real breadth of information about how clinical trials are conducted and timing around them and what's rate limiting to something else. And as you're mm-hmm. getting started, it takes a really long time to develop that knowledge. I remember first coming in to the role, and of course I had a lot of support. That's not the case in every single CRO. Some people will really just kind of feed you to the wolves, but at some places you will have a lot of support, and that's important to look for as you're choosing your CRO. To what extent are you going to have support to learn if you're new in the industry? So when I started, I had a ton of support, which was very helpful to me. I found less as I've moved along my career. But for the most part, I was quite overwhelmed as I got started because I really did not understand how all of these pieces fit in with one another. Yeah. And as a project manager, you know, it'll depend on if you're working on smaller studies, larger studies, if you're in a smaller CRO or larger CRO. But for the most part, you have to have, again, a really big breadth of knowledge to understand how our pieces are interconnected with one another.
Yeah.
And so there's the kind of a very fundamental like saying that they have in project management is like, if you will have a client essentially that's like, I need a baby. Like, I need a baby as soon as possible. And they want to know, can you get me a baby if you can get, you know, 9 pregnant people together? Can you get me a baby in a month? If you can find like 9 pregnant people right now, could you get me a baby in a month? And it's like, no, that's not how it works, because babies all the time take 9 months to make you a baby. And that's a really—
Lisa, I've got a question on that side of things, because it sounds like you're juggling quite a lot simultaneously, and there's a lot of pressure and questions coming from all angles. What would you say? I mean, you mentioned yourself that you've got a master's. Is there any particular qualifications that are needed? But more so, what are the particular skills or skill set that you would say that a good PM will have in order to be successful in dealing with all of these demands and, you know, kind of being able to go back to clients and saying, yeah, sure, I can sort that baby out, or whatever it is you need to do? What skills is it are involved?
So outside of just understanding your rate limiting factors within a clinical trial and having the project manager needs to have an expert understanding of the timeline. So every single piece of your timeline, how one thing here is going to have a cascading effect. It's going to push something else. Some things can be done in parallel. That really is the heart of project management. You know, a big portion of it is essentially managing a timeline and communicating what is going on with the timeline, not just within your internal team, so that you can say, you know what, we have a delay here. So that means I need X, Y, and Z resource. You need to go and work on something else right now. I'm giving you permission to maybe prioritize another project. Then I need you to come back at this point, because right now, you know, a good project manager will be constantly mindful of their resources time. So I don't want to, you know, if a week ago I needed all cylinders firing at once so that I could have an outcome to, you know, it was necessary for my timeline at one particular point. Then if I have a delay that affects another group, I need to let my other group know as soon as possible, guess what? You can breathe, because getting me your piece right now, I'm rate limited by 1, 2, 3, 4 other factors. So I want you to continue to maybe prioritize your time in a different way, take a rest, prioritize some other projects, then I'm going to tell you when you're needed and I need you on all cylinders again. So a good project manager has the foresight. You have to know what things will impact something else in the future. So I think about it like when you're in driver's ed and they tell you, you can't just look at the car in front of you. Like, you can't just depend on the brake lights of the car in front of you, because you won't have enough time to stop. You have to be looking at the car in front of that car, the car as far as you can see. When you see brake lights 10 cars ahead of you, that's your signal that there's going to be a cascading effect and you're going to stop. So a good project manager is able to think on a very, on a much larger scale than maybe an individual contributor who's just looking at, here's my piece, it goes here, here it goes here. And I don't say that in a pejorative sense, that their piece is not complicated, difficult, or frustrating to complete at times, because it is. There's no such thing as an easy role within a CRO. They're all very challenging roles. But the role of the project manager, what makes it a little bit different is you have to have the mindset, not only are you detail-oriented, because this is a detail-oriented profession, but you have to be very, very big picture. Again, you've got to see the brake lights up ahead to understand what the impact is going to be. Because another big part of the project manager role is that you are managing your relationship with the client. And this is the part that is a little bit hidden from the rest of the project team. The rest of the project team essentially interacts with project management when they're either getting told, quote, you know, something that they need to do, or they're looking at maybe internal meetings or sponsor meetings that are happening. But one of the really big pieces of a project manager's role is to manage the relationship with the client. The client gave you a lot of money to do their clinical trial. It could have been, you know, at the lowest end, like the very cheapest clinical trial that you can probably conduct, it's probably at least $1 million that they gave you to run their clinical trial. On the higher end, it could be upwards of $100 million to run their clinical trial. So however you slice it, whether it's $100 million or it's $1 million, that amount of money could bankrupt their company if you fail to execute on this or you fail to hit a deadline. So especially when folks are coming from outside of industry, there's a little bit less of an emphasis on deadlines. I'm not saying that they're not important, but within a CRO, being deadline driven is paramount to the role of the project manager. Again, there's a reason why a certain date is selected, whether it's for our first patient or we need to have the clinical study report at the end of the study provided to the sponsor. There's a reason that's driving these goals that we need to hit for our client. So being able to manage expectations, if I have a client that needs to take a data point such as, you know, we got our first patient in at this time, or this is, you know, first patient dosed, and they need to bring that to a meeting with an investor to get more money, there could be, you know, for example, maybe there's $20 million that's riding on that particular milestone for the client. So you cannot be a person that just shows up and says, oh, sorry, like we didn't get it. Like we didn't get it.
It sounds a high pressure. I'm just trying to soak this all up here, Lisa, and almost summarize kind of what you've just been saying. So a couple of things I picked out there is that you need to be super organized. You need to be able to manage timelines and budgets well. You need to have a good sense of anticipation, you know, kind of seeing that cart in front and the one in front of that and the one in front of that. And probably, I guess, the ability to manage stress. Now, so many CROs say this to me as a recruiter, you know, we need someone who can manage stress. Because with all of these things going on is one thing. Then you lump on top, you know, let's take that example of $20 million for a milestone. You add on that pressure. There is a lot of stress to it, because I guess if you're not cutting it, then it's likely that you could get cut. Is that the reality of it in CRO world, or?
So the reality in CRO world is that the stress is very real. And I've literally had companies that have said, because of some, you know, we have especially around COVID, like COVID was very, very stressful. We have some kind of buyer for a drug and we need to essentially have this drug, you know, put into a COVID indication by this date. And if it doesn't happen by this date, our whole company could go under. Like, that's a lot of pressure to put on yourself. They're not always that high pressure. I've certainly had some clients that are a lot easier to work with than others, but some of them really are. So when I say meeting deadlines, that's essentially to feed into how important it is to manage the client relationship. So if I have the foresight to know the way things are going, we will not get your first patient at the date that you're planning on getting your first patient. We will not have an interim analysis when you think you're going to have an interim analysis. The sooner I can get ahead of that narrative, the sooner my sponsor can get out ahead of it and they can start doing damage control on their end. So a good project manager, it doesn't always mean that you hit every single deadline. I have not hit every single deadline within this industry. Some have been impossible to hit for whatever outside circumstances have happened. COVID's a great example. A lot of people didn't meet deadlines when COVID happened, okay? We weren't expecting the world to shut down. But I've also had outside of, I remember working on a study earlier on, and I had research sites that were focused in they were in Puerto Rico, Miami, and Houston. And those were all my research sites. And in, you know, a matter of weeks, every single research site was taken out by a hurricane. Wow. I didn't know that was gonna happen. Okay. So there's definitely, you know, interesting things that can happen outside of our control. That's an extreme example of where we might jeopardize a deadline. So the important skill in there, the skill in there is that I can't control every single thing that's going to happen, but I have to have the foresight to be able to make my very best prediction and risk mitigation strategies. And I have to be able to have constant communication with my sponsor to let them know how things are looking. So again, they get the opportunity to do damage control on their end. So that's the skill. The skill is the communication. The skill is the bird's eye overview and the foresight, the plan, the risk mitigation. That's the skill. Mm-hmm. So to answer your question, what happens when something goes wrong? There's constant pressure, right? But if something goes wrong and you miss the deadline, typically there's a couple consequences. Typically, if you've done your part as a project manager to control that narrative, then your sponsor can be happy. I've had deadlines that were missed and I've still had very, very happy sponsors. And they said, wow, you all have done, I can't believe what a great job you did through this really challenging circumstance. Not every deadline is an angry sponsor. Sometimes they know
that,
the work
is that the
done.
Communication piece that allows that? I assume that's the only way, right? Because people get pretty peed off if they do not know what's going on.
Exactly. The moral of the story is don't spring anything on anyone. As soon as you know that something could go wrong, you address it and you essentially let your sponsor know these are all the mitigations that you're taking to try to prevent any you know further damage or fallout from something that may have gone wrong in the clinical trial. So it's communicating, it's being upfront, and a lot of times that's something I've observed with you know, sometimes project managers, especially when they're newer, they don't want to deliver bad news.
Mm-hmm.
It's a difficult skill. And sometimes we have to deliver bad news. Sometimes you may have something out of your control where maybe a vendor has dropped the ball on something, right? And I've had this happen before, and I won't go into detail because I won't disclose even in what area this happened in. But I've had cases where maybe a vendor quite didn't meet a timeline or didn't deliver a product that we were expecting. And I need to kind of go back to my client and say, there might not really be a great mitigation strategy here because this, you know, it's with another company, it's outside of our control, and, you know, it can get really complicated. So sometimes you have to deliver bad news and say something maybe didn't work the way that we were hoping it was going to work. Mm-hmm. We might not be able to achieve something in a certain amount of time. And you, at the end of the day, have to manage the relationship with the client. And sometimes, more often than not, depending on, some CROs are better about this than others, but some CROs are always chasing change orders. It's almost kind of part of their business model. Mm-hmm. But they say, yep, they may have a very wishful thinking budget and timeline for how a study would be achieved. And as they go, they need to essentially ask for more money as you go. That's essentially what a change order is. So there are some CROs that are better at this than others, but if you are working with a very change order driven CRO, you're not only managing the relationship with your client and saying, ooh, something maybe didn't go wrong, but also, can I have more money, please? And that is a really difficult conversation to have.
Nobody wants to be put in that situation. I was going to ask, I guess, you know, thinking of change orders and what you're talking me through here, does this vary? Probably I'll break it up into a couple of questions, otherwise it would just be too long. Does this happen more so during early phase studies or later phase studies? And is there, I guess, is there a differential between phase study and, you know, I guess participants and whatever? How does that impact the role of a PM?
So I have worked with, so I spent a little bit of time working in essentially generic drugs. And mm-hmm. So in generic drugs, we are almost like copying the homework of someone else. So someone else ran a clinical trial, and all we're really doing is running that exact same clinical trial the way that they did. So when I've worked in generic drugs, one of the things I really liked about that is they were much more predictable. I could almost plan all of my, you know, exactly when someone was going to go out to monitor, you know, patients. I could almost like book the flights the day we signed the contract and say, you'll need to be here, you'll need to be here. You know, I could almost book the flights that day. And there is a lot of predictability within those types of trials. So I actually really enjoyed that, because as a project manager, I do not like change orders. Then you might have something like a rare disease. And a rare disease may, no one may have ever done this before. We may be the very, very first people. So especially if you're working in an indication that is either rare or more complicated, if it has, especially in earlier phase, like where you're finding the dose, you don't really know how long dose escalation is going to go to find your recommended phase two dose. You're just kind of guessing how long you think that will go. So inherently, sometimes with earlier phase studies, we have to assume, and that's not a CRO trying to trick anyone. That's not us saying, we underbid it, so we could essentially come back with a change order. That's not anyone trying to be tricked. It's just the nature of early phase studies, where you just don't know how long they're going to take, or if you have an adaptive trial design, which is like we're kind of making up the design as we go because we don't know what's going to happen, then that is change order city, of course. And again, back to rare disease, you know, no one may have really understood how long it's going to take to get the patient population or some of the challenges because no one's done it. So if you know, on one side of the spectrum, you know, a generic study, probably not going to have a million change orders on a generic trial, but on a something very rare where we're in dose escalation, yeah, probably. But I realize I didn't answer your question. I'm a very long-winded speaker, but I realize I didn't answer your question before about what happens when something, like when it doesn't go to plan. As a project manager, you typically don't get fired. They don't fire you. So that's the good news for folks that are very nervous. They're very, very jittery when they get started. Am I going to lose my job? I hear that from new project managers. They're constantly messaging me on LinkedIn, calling me, am I going to lose my job because of X, Y, and Z? You don't typically lose your job if you screw something up. You can make your client unhappy, and your client can request another project manager. That means they're going to put you somewhere else. You'll stay within the CRO, you'll go somewhere else. But there is a real risk that if you have jeopardized a relationship with a client to an extent that they no longer want to even use your CRO, then they can take their business elsewhere. And if that is a really large clinical trial, that could essentially mean, especially with in a smaller organization or just a really big clinical trial, that could mean layoffs. That could mean not just you losing your job, but other people within your organization could lose their jobs as well because that clinical trial walked out the door. So I've had that pressure before, especially with small CROs where I've inherited internal rescue study. So a study that had essentially had the project manager replaced. And I'm the new project manager. I've assigned a new team. We're basically starting from scratch halfway through the study. And the pressure is very real. If this client walks out the door, if you cannot, like Lisa, if you cannot win them over, this client will walk off the door and we will have to do a reduction in staff.
Wow.
That's, you have other people's jobs on the line in those circumstances. And that's a pretty extreme circumstance. That's not going to happen to, I'm a more seasoned project manager. That's why I get things like that. You don't start off. I didn't start on my first day and they said, you have to save Christmas or, you know, something.
You know what though, Lisa, you may be overlooking the fact that you did have that level of tenacity though, because think back to that story that you told me of, you know, calling them up and saying, that's not good enough. I want to know why. And then managing to overturn that. So, you know, it's perhaps been there, you know, that's an attribute that you've had. And I'm kind of conscious of time here. I know that we're coming towards the end of our allotted slot. We've just been talking, but just and going on. I've got tons more questions. I don't know whether you're able to spare a bit more time or whether
I've got time.
Awesome stuff. Because yeah, I've got still, there's still so many questions I'd love to cover with you. But yeah, I think maybe you did have that, but now you've just got the experience head on your shoulders to go with that. I don't know what it is, like that passion or that resourcefulness to just get something done. And it seems that is something that PMs clearly need, is to be able to be resourceful and pull things together.
You have to pull things together. And one of the hardest things about being a project manager is you have to really motivate people. It's a huge part of it because you are no one's boss as a project manager. So there are sometimes project managers that try to rule with an iron fist, right? And I hear sometimes people saying, oh, you know, I'm kind of afraid of my project manager, or they're really like my boss. And that can happen in some CROs. Some CROs do give direct line management responsibilities to project managers. But in most CROs, you are no one's boss. And if you have people thinking that essentially like their job performance is hinging on you or their job is hinging on you, you are not an effective project manager. That's not how it works. That's cheating, essentially. No. And that is not a good way to manage your team. You have to really be able to explain why the work is important and understand it, again, prioritizing. And I see this all the time, like the example I was giving earlier, where there's a delay somewhere. And I've seen sometimes project managers not do that communication when there's a delay. That's just as important. Telling my people when they can pump the brakes is just as important as telling them when I need them to the races. Mm-hmm. And as a project manager, I have to be really tuned in to the level of stress that my team is under. And I need to really do my very best to manage that. And that's something that I definitely see with project managers where, yeah, they're always there to tell you when they need something fast and a really quick turnaround time. Mm. But they're not always communicating when someone can hold off on something, because I made a big deal about needing something on this date, you know, come heck or high water, I needed it at this time, but circumstances have changed. I no longer need it. I'm very good about those types of updates. That's important. Mm-hmm. You don't want to burn your team out. If you don't really need something on a date, allow them to work on other priorities, because they have other project managers that do need something.
Would you say then that's one of the, I guess, differences between, say, a project manager or a good project manager and a great project manager, is to be able to manage things when things are not at boiling point, to manage them before they reach that point, so that actually it doesn't reach that point, hopefully.
Exactly. That's what I'm always trying to not get ourselves into a boiling point. You have to be there sometimes, especially as a project manager. There are times of extreme stress that you will take under, but there's also times where you will have figured something out that was just very complicated. You will cross a hurdle and you'll feel really good about it, and people will celebrate you. So you get all the criticism of being, you know, in the project manager role, it's kind of like the person that works the front desk of a hotel, right? Like they hear when people are really mad, you take that, you take all of that, and you hear from folks that are really angry, but at the same time, just like the front desk person at a hotel, they hear about when someone, oh, we had the best, you know, day, they, you know, the kids are so happy. You hear that too. And that's the really rewarding part of project management, is when you know that you did something. Sometimes we have really, you know, the ability to, you know, I won't go into like, you know, a ton of details, but during this time, because I was working with generic drugs and had marketed, you know, generic drugs during the time where there was a lot of these natural disasters. Well, I was able to partner with my sponsor during that time, and we were able to get some supplies that were really needed, because they were already marketed drugs we were using, so they could be available in the region. So we were able to get some marketed supplies that we had reserved for our study, but the study wasn't going on. So we were able to get some medicines to people that needed them in shelters. So that's a really cool thing when I get to collaborate with a, we're always working on this longer vision, right? Of we want to have a drug that gets to bedside or gets into, you know, the supermarket, is available for purchase, whatever we're working on. We want to get it to a place where it benefits people or patients at some point. But sometimes that happens like 10 years later. Like it happens a really long time
later. It's a shame you have to take the rough with the smooth as well, by the sound of it. Wouldn't it be great if you could just do the good parts and not have to deal with all of the aggravation at times?
Yes, exactly. So there's really rewarding, and that's what keeps me here. If it was all stress, I couldn't do all stress. And sometimes we talk about the stressful parts. The conversation is a little bit more biased towards that. And the reason is because the stressful parts are extremely stressful. And if that's not for everyone, project management might not be for everyone, but it's certainly rewarding. And so there's parts of project management that I've really enjoyed, and it's been worthwhile. Another part of project management that is really challenging is that you have to be comfortable, I don't know, for lack of a better way of describing this, you have to be comfortable looking stupid sometimes. You learn in public, and that is also not for everyone. So when you're an individual contributor, if you get something that comes across your desk and you say, oh boy, I don't understand what this is, I'm going to have to ask someone for help, I need to spend some time digesting what it is, you can kind of struggle in private a little bit when you're an individual contributor. When you are a project manager, you are front and center all of the time. You're on meetings, if people are going to ask you really hard questions, and a lot of times you are not going to know the answers to every single question that someone asks. Mm-hmm. And that can be challenging for some folks, especially that come from research backgrounds where they're specialists. Area, they're a subject matter expert, and there's nothing that they don't know about that particular area. When you become a project manager, you will no longer have that luxury. You're working with many different disciplines, and you're going to be the face of many different disciplines. Mm-hmm. So people are going to put you on the spot in meetings. Sometimes our sponsor meetings sometimes they're really small and they're just kind of like one-on-one or small group conversations. And sometimes it's in front of, you know, a lot of sponsors will invite any person from their organization that wants to attend so that they can get updates on the clinical trial. So I've had sponsor meetings that there's 100 people on the call from the biotech company.
So it's more like a presentation rather than a meeting.
It can be, and it can absolutely be a presentation. And for that reason, sometimes we kind of have the more informal sponsor meeting that's done after the presentation. It all depends on what's wanted out of the pharma or biotech company. So some of them want that really big, elaborate hour presentation given to them. And it's a process, and some don't want that at all. Some people well, that's not a part of their job as a project manager to give these elaborate presentations. But sometimes we do have to give elaborate weekly presentations to really large groups of people. Then afterwards, you know, that doesn't always, there's not always time for meaningful discussion and hashing out details. So we kind of have a meeting after the meeting so that we can talk
about
one project manager, kind of like our secret meeting to really get things done. But so it'll depend on your CRO if you'll do this. At some, for these larger presentations, I wouldn't take this approach. But if I'm in a smaller meeting and a smaller group meeting, I was taught to do meeting minutes live, which is going to be very stressful for a lot of folks to do. So in a lot of CROs, you will actually have your meetings recorded, and you will have usually your project specialist will take your meeting minutes. Mm-hmm. And even in those environments, sometimes I do see a value of doing meeting minutes live, but it goes back to, it's in the same vein of, sometimes you're not always going to come across as the smartest person in the room. It's not my job to be the smartest person in the room. It's my job to make sure that every single person understands how we fit together. So one of the ways that I was taught to do that was to take meeting minutes live. So if I'm doing minutes live and we're talking about something that is quite that's quite in depth, and it might be whether it's a scientific discussion that's maybe a little bit over my head, or you know, we've got, you know, stats people talking to stats people, for whatever reason the conversation can be a little bit challenging. But I think it's important when you can, one of the skills that I bring to the table, but again, it goes back to, you're not going to feel like you're the smartest person for doing this, but you will be effective. So I take meeting minutes live and I say, these are the notes, these are the decisions that I have captured from the conversation. You know, we have an action item. So-and-so is going to be our decision maker, or these two people are going to continue to have a discussion. This is what they're going to discuss. We'll bring it to the meeting next week.
Nice.
And this is the decision that we're going forward with. It's on a screen. It's for everyone to see. Do we all agree with this? And they'll say, no, that's actually not correct, because we need to talk about, you know, some, I don't know, insert jargon for whatever.
I guess it helps with that, you know, coming back to what you were talking about earlier, it helps with that anticipation of what's coming next, because you know all sides have agreed, and it prevents you running into unexpected problems by the sound of things.
Exactly. And that being able to, because some project managers will essentially say, okay, there's a really complex conversation that's going on. It's very nuanced, and maybe I'll just kind of let that simmer for whatever reason, or let's hope that these people just work it out. But our approach really needs to be, again, I cannot be an expert in every single one of these disciplines. So, and that's one of the most challenging parts of project management is, you are not able to be the subject matter expert in every area, but I have to make sure that we're communicating with one another. We understand who our decision makers are, what essentially needs to be decided upon, and what that decision is limiting us to. So the rest of the group can know, even though this is a very dense scientific discussion, but at the end of the day, maybe it's getting us to, you know, the dose we're going to use in the study, right? So we don't know what our starting dose is that we're going to start for escalations, if we don't know what that is, then guess what? We don't get to, you know, finalize a protocol. If we don't finalize a protocol, that means we can't submit it to a regulatory authority or to our ethics boards, on and on and on. These are all the impacts of not having that decision. So it's having everyone, again, I'm not going to say, well, you know, based on the RAT model, I disagree that we should go, you know, I'm not going to give them that expertise. That's not my role. But my role is to make sure that we're having productive conversations, and we understand when decisions need to be made and what the impact is going to be on those decisions. Mm-hmm. So that can be challenging to step into that role, especially if you've come from maybe your little spot within whether academia or another organization as an individual contributor, where you knew any and everything that there was to know about your piece of the clinical trial. As the project manager, you need to assume a little bit more of a generalist role, and you will also kind of learn and perform in public. It's a very, very, very public role. And that can be uncomfortable for folks. So
awesome.
Take that into consideration. Everyone's watching you stumble sometimes, and that doesn't always feel good.
Amazing. Well, look, Lisa, you have shared so much. I feel like I've still got tons of questions, but the amount that you have shared already, I'll perhaps just have to do a round two at some point to get you back
on
for some more, because this has been amazing. But look, we close the show typically with some quick fire questions. I'll maybe amend them a little bit for yourself, but to close us off today, at least, and I'm definitely going to be getting you back, by the way, giving you a heads up. That's my live meeting minutes there. What is perhaps the one piece of advice that you would give to your younger PM self, and also to those who are just looking to get into things at the moment?
I think, you know, when I was starting out, I put so much pressure on myself to know everything. And if there was something I didn't know, I panicked. I froze. I just completely panicked. Mm-hmm. So I think taking a little bit of the pressure off of yourself, when you shadow people in this industry, your mentors, your bosses are typically people that have been doing this for a really, really, really long time. So my boss actually tells me this all the time, because I've recently transitioned out of project management into a strategy role. And so I'm going through all of those same feelings and experiences that I had when I was a new project manager. Mm. I'm going through those in my new role, right? And so my boss tells me all the time, he says, you know, you're observing and you're watching and you're learning from people that have been doing this for 10 years and 20 years. Don't expect yourself to be as good as someone who's been doing this for 10 years when mm-hmm. you've been doing it for a few months. So that's really my advice to new project managers. They always pair you with the best, right? They don't say, you're new in this company, so we want you to learn from this person who just, you know, sucks at their job. Like, they don't do that. They pair you with the best.
I hope not.
Yeah, hope not, right? No one learns, right? So they pair you with, you know, if you get a buddy, if they use that structure, not every CRO does, but I think it's a good structure to use to kind of have a buddy that you learn from. But again, your buddy was chosen to be a buddy because they're really good at this job. So don't feel this pressure to be as good as the person that's been doing this 10 years when you've been doing it for, you know, a couple months.
Awesome stuff. So kind of get comfortable with being uncomfortable, because you're not going to know it all. It's literally like, you can't compare your 2 weeks, or in your case to start with, or your 1 month to 10 years of experience of somebody who's been doing it day in, day out. Okay, cool. Next question would be, what would you perhaps list as the number one book or resource, podcast, website for our audience? In general, doesn't necessarily have to be PM related, but if it is, far away.
So I would actually say this isn't a hard resource, but I would say in your CRO, you'll typically have some kind of like learning management system that will have videos of trainings. Mm-hmm. Not every CRO is going to have access to this, but if you do have access to this, look at all of the videos, do a search for your business development folks. Because when you are a project manager or you're an individual contributor, like, you may have worked in one particular area, and we don't do a million trials at a time. You do, you know, depending on the complexity and the scope of them, you'll have anywhere maybe from one trial to maybe five trials that you're working on. So trials go on for a really long time, right? So you don't get to sometimes get the breadth of information that you'd like to have, that I'd always like to have. So I would say, if your CRO has training videos for your salespeople are selling the clinical trial. So they need to have a wide net of a breadth of information. So they need to, you know, they could be talking about someone running, you know, a rare blood cancer study. And then they also may need to talk to someone who's doing a diagnostic test that's a post-marketing study. Like, those are very different things. And they need to be able to have either a surface level or in-depth conversation, depending on and the client and their skill set and how, you know, BD is utilized within the CRO, but they have to have a really wide breadth of information. So I find that looking at the sales training, that's going to tell you just a lot about how your CRO is run. You might be surprised. You might learn more from the sales training about how the CRO is run than your project management training.
I think that that is the best recommendation as a resource I've ever had on the podcast. Honestly, just because it's a little bit out of the box, but also actionable and very useful. So I appreciate that one. I'll definitely be linking that one up to make sure that we get that out there to the audience and to LinkedIn. And look, I guess to close this up, we've spoken so much about business, your work, your entry into clinical research and what you've been doing in the role of the PM. But what do you do, Lisa, to relax and outside of work? You know, I always like to share that, you know, we do work in a very important industry, but at the end of the day, we're all people. We like some downtime. We like to relax. We've got families, etc. So what is your favorite thing outside of work when you're not watching BD trainings, teaching people about project management, explaining the differences between big CROs and small CROs? What do you do for a bit of enjoyment?
So I call myself an unapologetic couch potato, and I am a television enthusiast. That was actually my undergraduate major was television and film. Wow. I like my shows, and I almost go into a little bit of a depression when I don't have a show that I'm watching right now. I don't have a show that I'm watching, so I'm feeling a little lost and sad. But
sorry to remind you.
Yes, fine. I'll take any recommendations if there's something I should be watching. But you know, I make this isn't the sophisticated answer, right? But I spend a lot of time watching my shows, and I love them. I just finished rewatching The Last of Us. Oh my goodness, makes me so happy. I'm an infectious disease kind of person. I love working within the infectious realm. That's what gets me really excited in clinical trials. And so it's no surprise that I really like the infected zombie genre. That is my absolute favorite type of media to consume. So for me, that's, you know, I'm an unapologetic couch potato. And I also do a little bit, you know, in another life before I got into, you know, before I went to grad school, got into project management, I did gymnastics and I was a gymnastics instructor, and I'm just getting back into gymnastics now.
Nice.
And it's not an easy thing to, you know, pick up in your late 30s to go and get into gymnastics, but I'm getting back, and I'm actually going back into like an actual gym for the first time tomorrow.
Wow.
In a really long time. So that's my new hobby that I'm picking back up.
Awesome stuff. Well, Lisa, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. That for anyone that does want to reach out to you, I know that I've come across you regularly on LinkedIn, and we haven't even touched on that sort of too much. I know that you're a kind of fountain of knowledge on there. You share a lot, but what is the best way to get hold of you? Is it LinkedIn?
Yeah, I would say just, you know, shoot me a message on LinkedIn, and I do absolutely make my best effort to connect with everyone that I can. And if I'm not able, you know, if I don't think I'm going to be particularly helpful because, you know, I have a very specific within the industry. I know all things project management, and now I'm starting to know all things clinical strategy. So that's kind of where I sit. So sometimes folks reach out to me and they are like, oh, what's the best way to, you know, become a PK scientist? I'm like, I don't really know exactly the best way to become a PK scientist because that's not my area. So sometimes I'm not super helpful when you get outside of my lane. I'm not always as helpful. Yeah. So that's my best advice for folks. But certainly if you're interested in project management, I can talk circles around what that means and any recommendations that I have. But essentially, you know, send me something on LinkedIn. And if I am able to, if you have something that is something you're wanting out of the industry that I don't have experience in, I will do my very best to put you in contact with someone in my network that could be a better fit to have a discussion with.
Awesome stuff. Well,
Thanks again for joining me, Lisa. It's been an absolute pleasure.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much.